quarter, and we will be able to get down. One item we will skip today, I guess, is 2989 further work on new amendments to the bill. I think what we'll do is jump right into a public hearing on Senate Bill 1295 and call John McCauley and David Kroger.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCauley, representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Brokers, and I have with me David Kroger, who is president of the Oregon Association of Mortgage Brokers, who will be able to answer any questions you may have. We appreciate your willingness to bring this bill to the committee. Briefly, Mr. Chair, the bill is the result of a lot of discussion that has occurred early on in the session, and it took several months for an agreement to be reached on some minor changes, but some significant changes to the mortgage broker, mortgage banker law in the state. This bill would clarify that a mortgage broker is liable under the mortgage lender law only for actions involving the mortgage transaction. There have been cases where the bond that is required has been accessed for things beyond those transactions, unpaid rent, for example. And this bill clarifies that only those related to the mortgage transaction are covered. It specifies the damages under this law are limited to those involving money or property. It does not include non-economic damages. That would be a change in the law. And the third thing this bill does is applies to actions arising after the effective date of the act. So any actions currently in effect would not be affected by the act. This bill represents a compromise that's been agreed to by the industry itself, by the trial attorneys, and by the regulator, which is Department of Consumer and Business Services. I should also add, Mr. Chair, that earlier this session, Senate Bill 44 was passed and has currently been signed by the governor, which makes some other changes in the mortgage banker, mortgage broker law. And this bill does not conflict with those changes that were made earlier, and those primarily dealt with the bonding levels. With that, Mr. Chair, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Sure. Is there anyone from DCBS who would, that you contacted that wanted to come over and testify, or would you be willing to come over and testify on the bill?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kroger from DCBS is in the audience, did not sign up to testify. With this office, we've been discussing this measure.
And they bought off on the changes that have been. Come up forward and introduce yourself to the record, if you would. There's three seats there, I think.
For the record, my name is James Kroger. I'm the manager of the Mortgage Lender Program for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We work with the industry on their bill, and we do not oppose their bill, sir.
Okay. So it doesn't protect, it's not going to put consumers at risk for anything they wouldn't have been otherwise.
What it would effectively do, I believe, is eliminate frivolous lawsuits and lawsuits not based on the nature of the mortgage transaction.
Okay. Further discussion from the committee? Seems to be pretty quiet. So we'll go into the work session and see where everybody's at. We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 1295.
Mr. Chair.
What's going to start?
Senate Bill 1295 is the floor for the best recognition.
All righty. Colleagues, there are a motion before us to move Senate Bill 1295 to the floor of the House for a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so moved. Any volunteers for carrier? Christian Devlin's carriers in, and we'll close the work session on 1295. sent bill 1295. Please show Representative Edwards as excused. We'll now go to Senate Bill 299, and work session for public hearing on Senate Bill 299.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senate members. Senate Bill 299A comes to you from the Senate Judiciary Committee, where it passed 6-1, and it had a 20-10 vote on the Senate floor. The bill requires the Director of Water Resources Department to adopt by rule a process and standards for recognizing changes in the place of use, type of use, or point of diversion of water uses registered pursuant to ORS 539-240. That section is the bill. Validates rules adopted by the department before the effective date of this act to comply with those same provisions. It is okay. Water resources.
Martha Tagle.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Martha Pagel, Director of the Water Resources Department. My written testimony is being handed out to you. Senate Bill 299 was initially introduced at the request of our department. It deals with a fairly technical aspect of water law, and for those of you who haven't previously been immersed in water law, I'll try to give you a brief context that would certainly go into more detail if you need it and desire it. Basically, this bill amends our procedures for dealing with what we call pre-1909 water uses.
Yeah.
And these are the class of water users who made use of water under the general prior appropriation doctrine before Oregon adopted its first water comprehensive water law in 1909. And when the state did adopt that water law in 1909, we made provisions to say that those people who had put water to beneficial use and had actually vested that water use before 1909, that they would be able to continue making use of water in that fashion. And a process was set up called an adjudication, whereby we have to work as kind of an administrative officer for the court, but basically it's a judicial process to by which people file claims demonstrating that they have these pre-1909 uses, that they have continued that use since 1909, and that they are now entitled to have that use recognized in a court decree. That adjudication process is lengthy and expensive. It involves many claimants in any given basin. We do it on a basin-by-basin basis throughout the state. And at this point, the good news is that we've completed adjudications in 70% of the state's basins geographically. We have not completed adjudications in most of the west side of the state, where we have a lot of water users and a lot of people who are potentially affected by the adjudication. That's the background. What this bill does is clarify that those people who have these pre-1909 uses in unadjudicated areas can go through a process, an administrative process, working with our department to make changes in the place of use, the type of use, or the point of diversion. If these people held a state-issued water right, we'd call that change a transfer process, and we have a clear statutory and rule process that they can go through to accommodate those changes that allow a water user to continue making reasonable and efficient water use. Because these people are in the pre-1909 category, we don't have that clear process. In 1990, our department adopted by rule a procedure for recognizing those types of changes. It includes a notice and it includes an evaluation of potential injury. And we have never had any complaints about those rules, but recently have been advised that it would be well to have some clarification that the legislature did intend for us to have the authority to do those rules. And that's why this bill is before you. In a few words, the bill says that we are authorized to adopt such rules and that the rules that we have in place and the people who have benefited from those rules are validated.
Thank you very much. And there's been significant controversies going around this thing, which involving one specific non-adjudicated water right in Springfield. but it is much, much broader than that, and I think it would be beneficial if we considered it in a broader context. We do have one individual, Rosemary Ryan, kind of to testify. Any questions at this point for Martha Pagel?
Mr. Fire. Is there a lawsuit or anything that prompted this action by the Attorney General to look at the rules and say that, oh, by the way, you're not following the law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, there's not a lawsuit. This particular controversy involving the City of Springfield, their interest in taking advantage of this law is what brought it forward and raised some questions and caused the AG's office to look at it and advise us. But there hasn't been any lawsuit filed on it. There's been no challenge to the rule thus far.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes. Just so I'm clear again, that for the record, this bill does affect, it's broader than just the Springfield issue that we're seeing. So, and just describe one more time how it does affect the adjudicated land, process for the land.
Mr. Representative Edwards, to be clear, the bill is in generic form. It affects all people who have filed registration notices with us. That means that they've given us prior written notice that they have these pre-1909 claims. That's roughly about 600, mostly on the west side of the state. And it is not likely that we will get to the adjudications in those areas in the near future. And by that, I mean years and years. We're currently in the Klamath Basin, and it'll probably take us another 3 to 5 years to complete work there before we even begin another process elsewhere.
That's very extensive.
It's a very extensive process. We've budgeted, we've spent about $1 million staff budget, general fund budget in our department for the last 2 years on the Klamath Basin. We have another $1 million appropriated for the next the coming biennium.
And if an individual has a non-adjudicated water right, say here in the Willamette Valley, and we have a listing of a species, say a steelhead or a salmon or some such critter, and needs to, as a result of that, move his point of, his or her point of diversion, the process is may or may not be legally sufficient that it's currently available. But this would provide a process.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And I should be clear that our department has historically tried to work with the water users and recognize these changes. We did it before we had rules. We just took notice and put it in their file. Since 1990, we've had a process by rule. But if they don't have that opportunity or if there's a cloud on it, it does put a severe constraint on the water use until we get to the adjudication.
Okay. Let's finish our...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a new issue for me. Can you explain as brief and concise as possible that the process by which you go through, you have an unadjudicated water right and you're changing the use of it, that the rule process or how you settle just a little light on that for me?
Mr. Representative Starr, the process that they would go through is they would file a notice with us. We would look at the current use of, and we would look at the registration to make sure that they are using water in conformance with the notice that they previously filed. We then do an evaluation to make sure that this change doesn't result in an injury to other water rights. That's a basic test that's applied for other types of water rights to go through transfer. We also look to see whether there would be any change in any adverse impact on other water uses, even that aren't under water rights, but a kind of a change in the way that particular system operates. And if we meet those tests, then we would note the change and put it in their file. Then when it comes time for the adjudication, the court would be able to look at the original registration and then the change that we authorized by this process.
Just a quick follow-up. So you do look at other water users to ensure that they're not harmed in any way by the change?
Yes, we have an injury test. Mr. Chair, Representative Sharp, we need to review each proposed change to see that it will not result in injury to other water right holders or net loss of water available to downstream users or an expansion of the right under the original registration, which is comparable and maybe even a little more than we do on a typical transfer application for.
Do you have, in that process, do you have the ability for other water users to appeal? They say they disagree with the department in your, you know, assessment that it doesn't or whatever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, we don't have that process spelled out in the rules at this time. Earlier in the session, we were looking at amendments that were more comprehensive and spelled out the process. So, no, we don't have a clear process. We do publish notices of actions that we take. So there is technically and legally an opportunity for people to file objections or ask for reconsideration, but I would have to say that we don't have any specific process for inviting comments or protests or anything like that. It's something that we could consider doing in future rulemaking.
Thank you for if I can explain just a little bit here. So there's not a public process that other water users don't have enough opportunity to comment. Is that?
Mr. Representative, sir, under the rules as they are right now, that's correct.
Do you find this process as controversial as you go? I mean, it seemed to me that it would be, and that it would. It seemed to me that it would behoove or be beneficial for the opportunity, you know, to get folks at the table.
Sir, Representative, sir, I would agree with you that, and almost all of our other processes that are spelled out in rules or in statute do provide advanced public notice and opportunity for comment, and we're certainly not opposed to that. This has been kind of a sleepy provision for a long time, and nobody ever really paid attention to it until the particular case came along with Springfield, and that's the way it's operated. We've had about 30 or 40 changes that we've recognized by these existing rules, and there haven't been any questions or concerns raised about those ones that we've done in the past. But there isn't a process right now, and we'd certainly be open to that.
So apparently there hasn't been a problem until the situation in Springfield came up, is that?
Correct.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you doing the Lowndes Basin in its entirety, or are you splitting off the sub-basins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, we are not currently doing the Willamette Basin. A few of the sub-basins within the Willamette has been done, and it may be that we would proceed in that fashion, but right now we haven't even charted out the workload for the future. We're concentrating on the Willamette.
Which sub-basins have you done?
Chair, Representative Barr, I don't know off the top of my head, but I could get that for you. I think the San Am or these portions of it, I could get that for you.
Okay. One more. Mm-hmm. Will this at all affect the issue with the Thompson's Mill down the Talpuia?
Chair, Representative Barr, I believe that they have either decreed or state issued water rights. I'm not sure. It hasn't come to my attention that it would affect that. That's another one I could check for you. Seems to me they have an 1800 water right, which would indicate that it is pre-1909, and it may be that they're in a sub-basin that's been decreed, or it may be that, yes, in fact, it's a pre-1909 right that would benefit or not from this provision. I'd have to do some research on
it. I think we appreciate that, because they do, in fact, have one of the oldest water rights in the state, I believe, or at least in that basin, it is pre-1909. I didn't know that much.
Martha, if you'd be so kind as to stand by, we may have more questions for you as we move along here. What I'm going to do here is call the proponents and then call the opponents that we in that order. We'll call Rosemary Ryan, City of Springfield. Introduce yourself for the record and let us know what you think.
Very good. My name is Rosemary Pryor. I'm with the City of Springfield. Chair Simmons, I'm here to respond to any questions you may have about the project that the City of Springfield has to undertake, so I would be more than happy to do that.
Okay. I don't know that we have enough information for the committee at this point to have a lot of questions for you. I have read through the information provided to me both by the attorneys for the vineyards and then
also some of the chronology and information provided to me indicated the actions of the city of Springfield specifically related to that that situation. But if you'd be willing to stand by, sure. We'll allow I'll call Mr. Doug DePriest and Roger and Kathy Vineyard. And introduce yourself to the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Simmons, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Doug DePriest, and I represent Roger and Kathy Vineyard, who are seated with me. The vineyards immediately and adversely affected if this bill were passed, as the city of Springfield has threatened to condemn an easement through the middle of the vineyard property to move a point of diversion upriver. We urge you to vote no on Senate Bill 299. With due respect to the position of the Department of Water Resources, this bill bristles with legal and policy issues. What are some of those issues? I propose only to address three of them: lack of need, lack of fairness, and lack of fish protection. Springfield, a major proponent of this legislation, claims it needs Senate Bill 299. Yet the city of Springfield could pump water into its mill race to supplement late summer flows. In fact, in 1995 and again in 1997, the Oregon Division of State Lands asked the city to steady pumping. But to date, the city has never given pumping serious consideration. The Department of Water Resources would like to clarify its authority for its existing rules and says a number of claimants would benefit. Even if this is true, that is not a sufficient reason to pass a bad bill. Why do we say this is a bad bill? Lack of fairness and lack of fish protection are a couple of the reasons. Regarding lack of fairness, this bill would facilitate water claimants whose rights have never been determined to allow them to condemn private property to change a point of diversion or a place of use or the type of use on unadjudicated water claims. Again, this is before the existence, the nature, or the extent of the claimed water right has ever been proven or established. We respectfully submit that it is simply not fair that a party with an unproven claim should be able to condemn another person's private property. This would be a different issue if it arose after a water right had been certificated by the department or adjudicated by a court. But here we're talking about water claims that have never been officially established. The remedy of condemnation is a drastic remedy, and the question is, should it be utilized in the hands of a right claimant as opposed to a property right holder? And here we have the prospect of a party that says to the Water Resources Department, we think we can prove a water right of X amount, and while we're waiting for that to be determined, in the meantime, we wish to condemn some private property to be able to make changes to that. And we submit that is not fair to the property right holder. We have submitted, and it should be passed out to you, copies of testimony that we submitted on the Senate side and have opened it to language that's a proposed amendment that would address the condemnation issue. If this were added to the bill, and I want to make clear that we oppose the bill, but if this were added to the bill, it would satisfy the Department of Water Resources' desire for express authority for the rules it now has. But it would take care of the problem of jeopardizing private property owners like the Vineyards in the meantime. as an aside, despite what you may have heard from Mr. Campbell or other Springfield representatives, Springfield has offered to pay the vineyards only a little more than fair market value for their property. Now, if the vineyards were willing, wanted to sell their land, that might be a fair offer. But since the vineyards don't particularly want to sell and are under threat of having an easement condemned through the middle of their property, they do not feel fairly treated by that offer or by the city. The vineyards face a very difficult problem. Sell a property they love or stay and see it bisected by an engineered channel which would destroy wetlands and which would impair riparian habitat in the process. Which brings us to the issue of fish protection. Another problem with Senate Bill 299 is the lack of fish protection. And this is one of the instances where we would agree with the committee's comments that this is broader than just a Springfield issue. Why are fish an issue? Well, Senate Bill 299 would allow diversions of water at new locations or even for new uses, with no provisions for fish screening. There are no provisions for fish screening in Senate Bill 299, and if you review the rules that this bill would ratify, there are no provisions for fish screening there. Now, by contrast, compare that with existing state statutes for changes, as Ms. Hagel testified, they're called transfers, to post-1909 water rights that have been determined, certificated by the department, or adjudicated by, or pre-1909 rights that have been adjudicated by the court and they're treated like post-1909 certificated rights. There is an express provision in existing state statutes that says there should be a review for possibly requiring fish screening before changes are made. Again, the Senate Bill 299 and the rules that would ratify do not contain a comparable provision. Now, the Department of Water Resources said on the Senate side they would be willing to add such a requirement to the bill. But the SB 299 got through the Senate without fish screening being added. Given recent heightened concern for the health of salmon and steelhead populations, this is a significant issue, one that SB 299, as presented to this committee, fails adequately to address. In fact, if you think about it, if Senate Bill 299 passes, it would be easier to change pre-1909 water claims that have never been adjudicated than it would be to change post-1909 certificated rights. That makes no sense. In summary, there is lack of need, there is lack of fairness, and there is lack of fish protection. We submit you have at least three good reasons to vote no. And there are other issues, particularly the change in type of use and the inconsistency with current laws, but we know your time is limited. Alternatively, if any of you individually happen to be considering voting for this bill, we urge you to consider the language that we have submitted to you on a relating to the condemnation issue, because as we noted, it would accomplish the department's purpose of having some express authority for their rules. But it would address the problem of having claimants having superior rights over property rights holders. We thank you for your time. We are available to answer questions that you might have.
Did you have any statements for the Commissioner and Mr. Bender?
Chairman, I don't think that you do have a comment right now.
Okay. Mr. Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This fish protection issue, are you saying that Springfield, if this were to go through, wouldn't have to do any screening or of any kind in the event that, you know, they're taking water out of the stream? It seems to me that those issues would be governed by other statutes that would require such action.
Well, right now, if the city had a certificated water right, which they don't. The change, the transfer process in the Department of Water Resources statutes expressly provides, as part of the Department of Water Resources review for the possible transfer, review by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and could result in fish screening. But this bill and the water resources rules for changes to these unadjudicated pre-1999 rights has no comparable provision, and oftentimes the comments of Department of Fish and Wildlife, while as a resource agency, are recommendations to regulatory agencies. Fish and Wildlife will make recommendations to Division of State Lands, recommendations to Department of Water Resources, and often rely on the regulatory authority of other agencies to implement their recommendations. But one of the problems with the lack of having that process built in to this bill is that there is no vehicle by which the recommendation of the Department of Fish and Wildlife would automatically be obtained.
Just to kind of follow up, if we had a commitment from the Director of the Water Resources Department to incorporate that in the rules, would that suffice?
That would not suffice because of the property rights issue and the condemnation issue, but it would be a step in the right direction.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, on another issue. You talked about destruction of riparian areas.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me that we've come great strides in mitigating those issues, that we could, in the process of the diversion, create additional riparian areas. Is that not an option?
It is theoretically an option. However, in Oregon wetland statutes, there is a sequence that one is supposed to attempt to follow in evaluating whether wetlands can be adversely affected. And the first step in that process is to see if one can avoid destroying the wetlands. And we submit here that if the sequencing in the Division of State Land statutes for mitigation were followed, that the answer should be City of Springfield can pump and can avoid dredging out the wetlands that are on the vineyard property. And then if you can avoid it, then you shouldn't get to step two, and that is, can you build wetlands somewhere else to offset? And I would say that humans are a lot more effective at destroying wetlands than they are creating functioning wetlands.
If I can continue to check all I would just disagree with that last statement, because I've seen actually all over the state my fellows around with humans have done significant work in creating, you know, wetlands and riparian areas and recognizing the importance of those to salmon and major species restoration. But another question I had was, wasn't the idea, the issue of pumping, hasn't that been studied by a couple of different engineering firms and with similar results, and that it really would work very well or at all?
Just a few months ago, City of Springfield commissioned a study by Brown and Caldwell, and it showed that there are, based on the approach that Brown and Caldwell used, there are somewhat greater costs for pumping than there are for a gravity flow diversion, where you go up, you know, a few hundred feet, several hundred, many hundred feet upstream. We submit that the Brown and Caldwell study shows the feasibility of pumping, and that there are, it's our belief that there are political considerations at the city where they would like to be able to connect a park that's on one side of the vineyard property with city-owned land on the other side of the vineyard property and create an amenity, this channel, and that there are other reasons why the city would like to do this, but that if you ask the question, is pumping feasible? Yes. Would pumping cost somewhat more? Yes. Is pumping a viable alternative for the city? Our belief is yes, it is. And our belief is that the engineers that have done the studies for the city of Springfield have understood when they took on their assignment in weighing pumping versus gravity flow, they understood the policy preference of their client.
Now, just a minute. Wasn't one of the engineering firms chosen by your clients of engineers?
Yes, and the engineering firm that was chosen by our clients came up with a proposal for pumping that would have actually involved an excavation in the uplands and a pond, and the water would flow through the gravels and would be in the pond and available for pumping into the existing channel, as opposed to putting a pump in the river. And so, yes, the expert that the city did fund an expert that the engineers chose, and he came up with a pumping option.
Could I make a comment, Chairman? One of the things that the Brown and Caldwell study says is that it would cost twice as much to remove the rock from the ground as you could sell it for. That makes it look like it's going to cost too much money for them to study pumping. If any of the sand and gravel companies, if it costs them twice as much to remove rock from the ground that they could sell it for, they wouldn't be in business. And that's $400,000 that weighs against the pumping option. So we just find it curious that
it weighs against the pumping option that you're advocating.
Right. So, how can it cost you twice as much to remove rock and turn around and sell it for half that much money? That doesn't make any sense. Sand and gravel companies wouldn't be in business if that's the way it worked.
And the point that he's trying to make is the Brown and Caldwell study said it's more expensive to pump than to use gravity flow. On the other hand, a key basis for their conclusion that it was more expensive is this $400,000 extra cost to remove gravel, which we think is an unsupportable extra cost. And so we think if that adjustment were made, actually the cost of pumping the gravity flow works out to be about a wash. It's comparable. So that supports our contention that pumping is feasible.
Yeah.
Would that be comparable in terms of capital expenditures? But certainly looking at long-term operating expenditures, if something is going to take that
it's comparable over 20-year life cycle costing.
And what we're talking about isn't a rock pit, a rock quarry. It's paying people to dig it out and then dispose of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of a difference there between doing that and opening a rock quarry.
That's correct. Another option would be direct pumping from the river, and they would not have the cost of the rock removal and maintaining the pond. And that was studied briefly in an earlier OTAP report, but has not been considered since the time the Division of State Lands directed the city to study pumping more carefully. So OTAC did a report, had pumping as one of the alternatives. DSL said, we want you to look at pumping. OTAC did another report. It did not have pumping in it. And that's very puzzling to us. And the subsequent OTAC study included, it excluded pumping, which DSL had asked the city to study. It included two alternatives that DSL had told the city the DSL disfavored. And so that suggests to us that the city has for quite a long time wanted to pursue the gravity flow option and has looked askance at another viable alternative.
Okay. Do you have any reason to believe, Mr. DeFries, that when adjudication takes place in the area there around Springfield, that the claim that the city of Springfield has for the water that fills the mill race will not be recognized?
That is an interesting question, and it's a difficult question to answer.
Just give me a yes or a no.
I have no idea.
Okay. We'll ask Rosemary Pryor the same question.
Yeah, the city only acquired its property along the mill race in the mid-1980s. The mill rates started out being very short in the early 1800s. It's been lengthened various times. It's been put to various uses. Uses have started. Uses have stopped. We seriously doubt that the city would be adjudicated to have the full allocation that they have claimed and for what uses. And there's also been a change in point of diversion prior to the Department of Water Resources rules, how, what a court will think about that post-1909, pre-1990 change in point of diversion. I don't know how a court's going to look at that. And the court's decision may be based on facts that none of us are aware of at this point.
Questions? Okay, thank you. Stand by. Rosemary Fire. How many individuals are served by the water and mill rate?
I don't have a specific number, but I can tell you that there are downstream industrial users and that the water in the mill race replenishes groundwater that supplies wells maintained by the Springfield Utility District that supply a third of Springfield's drinking water.
This is it's a significant volume of water that flows through the mill race.
It is.
And do you have any reason at all to believe that when adjudication takes place in the area, that the claim for the water that flows through the mill race will not be recognized?
Certainly the city of Springfield's crystal ball isn't any better than Mr. Dupree's, but no, I don't have any reason to believe that the claim which came to the city with the mill property from Georgia Pacific would not be upheld.
Okay. The three engineering studies, is it, I thought I saw something that said that both the engineering studies came up with the same conclusion.
That's correct. In the course of numerous different conversations that our city manager has had with Ms. Lindsay Vineyard and their legal counsel, he's tried to explore all manner of either mitigation or perhaps we could enhance the terms of an easement with construction of a footbridge or anything we could do to make the creation of this waterway or the reopening of this previous waterway across Mr. and Mrs. Vineyard's property more accessible to them. And so in the course of doing so, tell me again what your question was. You spoke to...
The engineering study.
Right. I'm sorry. My mind wandered as I was trying to answer your question. In the course of those conversations, when Mr. and Mrs. Vineyard said we're concerned that the city hasn't looked at alternatives that would not cross our property adequately, the city manager invited Mr. and Mrs. Vineyard to select an engineer of their choosing, anyone they wished, and at city expense, we would invite that engineering firm or engineer to go back to all of the studies that have been done since 1990. And if there's something that the city is not considering adequately, we would go there. The first report was from a firm called Intranco, and they came back and essentially said, we don't see any reason why the city should be moving off of the existing preferred alternative. If you can appreciate, Mr. and Mrs. Vineyard were not satisfied with that, and so the city manager said, pick another firm. We'll do this again. We truly want to find a happy resolution. That would be our goal. And the second engineering firm was Brown and Caldwell, and I have the specific words, but in effect what they said was we see no reason why the city should move away from the existing preferred option, which is the gravity option and moving the intake. The comment was made that we haven't adequately explored pumping, and at no time has the city said we cannot pump. But what we have been told by all of the consulting engineering firms is that we can't pump from the present intake location. So even if the council were to choose to go there and pay the additional annualized cost, capital and annualized cost of pumping, we can't do it from the current spot. So we're sort of back to ground zero again, which is the need to move the intake to a different location and the desire to have some clarity that if we do that, we're not going to inadvertently or cavalierly put that water right, whatever it is, at risk in the future. So that's our goal.
Okay. Questions from the committee? President Stark.
Thank you. Did you purchase the property with the plan to use the water?
Did we purchase the
Apparently you purchased a property that has a water right, is that correct?
No, what happened was in 1985, Georgia Pacific gave the city a Booth Kelly lumber mill property that's located right in downtown Springfield.
Okay.
With it came a mill pond and this 100-year-old hand-dug mill race channel. It's a really important community asset for us.
Okay. And it's, all right. That's my question. Other questions from the committee? Okay. Martha, you come back up, please.
If this bill passes and you were to go through the rule process, in that process, would you adopt rules similar to the ones we have for the adjudicated water rights, where they have to, you have to run them by, at least run them by the Department of Fish and Wildlife for them to comment?
Chair Representative Starr, if we do further rulemaking, then we would most certainly go through a process that would include that kind of input. And my best guess would be that, yes, we would include that because those are issues that are really important to us now. They weren't in 1990 when the existing rules were adopted. I guess what would be helpful to me is to have clarification of legislative intent, whether you expect us to do immediate rulemaking. We have in place these rules that have operated fairly well until the Springfield situation came up. And what the bill would do is basically ratify those rules and allow us to continue working with them, which we would be prepared to do. I am happy to offer to you a commitment that we will, as soon as we can work it into our rulemaking schedule, deal with some of these other issues of additional notice and process and dealing with the fish. But it's not otherwise our intention to do that rulemaking immediately because we have the rules in place, and our primary goal is to make sure that people other than the city of Springfield are not placed in jeopardy because of this particular controversy. And that's what happened. We probably wouldn't be here with the bill because our rules were working just fine. But when this controversy arose, then it called into question the practice that we've had and the rules as they've applied to a lot of other people, and that's my concern.
How many other people approximately? You mentioned earlier, would you affect them?
We've processed about 30 to 40 under the existing rules. There are a total of about 600 people who have filed registration statements who would be eligible to benefit from these rules.
Lost my train of thought here. Destruction of wetlands and creation of additional wetlands, mitigating that issue, destruction of riparian areas and mitigating that. Can you comment on process there? Do you, in your other, on the other side of these that have been adjudicated, do you have specific processes you go through to deal with those issues?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stark, we don't have any specific rules relating to wetlands issues, and that's because in most cases, if there's going to be removal or fill activity within a wetland, that's covered by permits issued by the Division of State Lands, and our permits typically deal with just the in-water activity. Sometimes a removal fill permit might be required, sometimes not, so we don't deal with it specifically in our process. If I may, I also wanted to add in on the similar issue relating to impacts on fish and fish screening. The Department of Fish and Wildlife has freestanding separate authority to require fish screens on these types of diversions, and so we have that now in our statute, but even without that, as for example to other existing water rights that were issued before those statutes came into being and aren't proposing a transfer, they could still be required to put in fish screens, as could these pre-1909 uses under the Department of Fish and Wildlife separate authority.
Yeah, that's what I had thought. That's very good thought. Okay. That's helpful. Thank you very much. That's helpful.
And if we didn't pass this bill, it would place in jeopardy the other 30 or 40 who have processed under your current rules, and the others who have filed together a number of individuals that filed to potentially change the location would also be placed in jeopardy.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's our primary concern, is that there's now a cloud over the authority by which these rules were adopted in the first place.
I'm perfect here to clarify that.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Going to work session on Bill 299.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
I move Senate Bill 299 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Mannix. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I have read the documents which have been submitted, and although I came in late on the testimony, I understand the gist of the argument. I'm satisfied that the bill that's presented to us is good public policy. The proposed amendments, I do not think, are good public policy because they would delay condemnation actions that may be necessary in a variety of circumstances, and so I'm not prepared to propose any amendments.
Thank you very much. I agree. Representative Starr.
Well, Mr. Chair, colleagues, I'm a little hesitant to support this. All the information I have makes me think that this is great. This is an important bill that we gotta pass. Yet I'm not sure that I have a full enough picture of all the issues. Now, if this dealt only with Springfield and not with the rest of the state on adjudicated water rights, that'd be one thing. But this, I think, has more far-reaching impacts than just Springfield. So a little uneasy at this point about moving forward. Got a motion that I guess I'll have to vote on, but. I likely will support the motion to the floor with the caveat that I continue to study the issue and I might change my vote on the floor.
Mr. Mannix?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, if the bill dealt only with Springfield, I'd probably oppose it because I think that actually there's a lot of water rights owners out there around the rest of the state who need to be protected by the rulemaking process as it's been set up, and I think the statute is important to protect them. What will happen in the future is this issue has now arisen, and if we didn't apply it statewide, my brethren in the bar will certainly find ways to start sticking it to people in other situations. And I think that's why we need to take care of it on a statewide basis.
I see that as the real issue here. Provide some assurity with unadjudicated water rights to be able to change the point of diversion without having a big question mark hanging over their ability to actually do so until the adjudication process finally takes place, which is going to be a number of years as we slowly move through that basin by basin in the state. And as indicated earlier, it's a very expensive process, and this would just kind of get us through until that happens. Representative Starr?
I appreciate Person Mannix's comments. This is an important issue. And it's important to a lot of folks in this state. I kind of like to know, and we don't have folks in the audience from our ag and natural resources communities.
I'd hope for them.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know, you know, what kind of response they might have in issues like this.
Let's hope it's Farm Bureau and Organic Food and Shelter and representatives of those organizations, and they said they were neutral on the bill. They were neither going to support or oppose.
That's a good one. Those are the folks that are going to have a significant impact.
Mm-hmm.
I do have comfort in the fact that the process by which they go through make certain that they don't have negative impact to other water users. So it's worth it.
Okay. You have a motion in here?
You have a motion.
Mr. Chair, it was some questions I asked dealing with the Calpulia and Thompson's Mill addressed at all?
Be happy to call Mark to take it back up to see if she can answer that.
She couldn't answer them at this time, is what she said.
Okay, and I don't know how that fits in here exactly.
Chair Representative Byer, Mark the table for the record. I'm sorry, I just don't know the answer with respect to Thompson's Mill. I think something in the back of my head tells me that they may have been one of the sub-basins that was already adjudicated. If they're not, then this bill would be essential for them to move forward with the plan that they've proposed, because it includes the concept of transferring of the water right being the property being purchased by the state and the water right being used for in-stream purposes. That is a change in use that would be subject to this bill. So if they're not, if they're pre-1909 use in an unadjudicated basin, this bill would be important to them. And we'll find out for you and try to get that information as quickly as possible.
As I understand, the answer is if you like the Thompson Mill situation, the proposal, then this bill helps and doesn't hurt, and the lack of this bill might hurt. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, I will support moving the bill today, but with the caveat that if, in fact, there is new information concerning that issue, that either the bill will be moved up and done, or I'll vote against it.
Okay.
Let's call the roll.
Okay, Beyer.
Aye.
Devlin.
Aye.
Edwards.
Aye.
Gardner.
Aye.
Manning.
Aye.
Carr.
Aye.
Fitzsimmons.
Aye. And Senate Bill 299 goes before the due pass recommendation, and I will find a carrier.
Wouldn't you be a good carrier?
I was thinking that same thing. And then maybe stuck with this one myself. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 299. And we will go into a... we have one more item that we can deal with today on our agenda. That is Senate Bill 686. And we'll open a work session on and ask for some testimony from the Department of Corrections today.
And, Mr. Chair, the new information that you have since your last meeting on the 25th are the Dash 14 amendments.
Okay. Which Representative Beyer had handed in here.
That's correct.
Okay. Mr. Cook, can you relate to us any thoughts the Department of Corrections has on the issue pending before us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections. Yes, sir, I can. I appreciate the fact that the committee is taking this issue up. This has been a three-year-plus road, a long, difficult, arduous road for a lot of people. A lot of emotions are at play here. A lot of facts have been represented to the group, and I think a lot of information that we are prepared, both Sueka and myself, to respond to if you, in fact, have questions around specific issues. But on the whole, just very briefly, given it's the end of a long day, I'm sure, for all of you and us, we are supportive of the A11 amendments to 686. We believe Day Road to be an appropriate site for the site and the corrections facility that would include the Women's Prison Intake Center concept. I don't know what else to add to that other than to say that a significant, and I do mean significant, amount of work has been done in siting. Not to trivialize this in any way, but when all of us go out and look for a house, we may look at several homes and make a decision. We have looked at literally hundreds of sites around the state, particularly on the reopening of this. We looked at hundreds of sites in the metropolitan area. We have selected now, we think, in Day Road, the best site available. And I think that it always could be left open for conversation about whether something else is superior to that. But this site will do everything the department needs to do. It will do what the state needs to have done in terms of housing offenders. It will be appropriate for the reintroduction of criminals back into the community, which occurs in 96% of the cases. It provides a lot of programming and other opportunities along the way to ensure that some success can result from the time they spend in prison. And we are supportive of the A11s and think that it's the appropriate action to take on the part of this body in the Senate.
Hey, Mr. Cook, if we were to stick the A11s into the bill, how long would it take? And if the governor were to sign it, how long would it take to break ground and get a facility established there at Day Road?
Mr. Chair, we would begin the process immediately. We have already done significant design work. Additional design work would have to be done, but groundbreaking per se would occur in the spring of next year.
prior to that time, essential work that has to be done prior to construction would be done, so no time would be lost in terms of the activity.
Clearing the ground, there's trees on that site, there's a lot of
dust. There's clearing the ground, there's infrastructure issues to deal with, but in fact, there are a lot of design issues left. What we found in the CMGC process we used at Snake River and at Umatilla was if you build and design simultaneously for speed, there are costs associated with that and there are problems that occur. In this case, we would be more direct in terms of some of the design work, trying to reduce costs of construction as we go and be ready to actually begin construction May of next year with about a 27 or so month window for completion of the facility.
Okay.
Thank you. You're supporting the J Road site. At this point, wasn't J Road considered in the original siting process? And if it's such a great site, why didn't the Prison Siting Authority recommend it to the governor instead of damaging the sites in Washington County?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, Dave Road was not considered in the original siting process. Dave Road was a decision made late in the siting process during an emergency board session proposed by the City of Wilsonville, supported by the City of Wilsonville, supported by the leadership, and directed the Department of Corrections to look at that site. We did, in fact, Representative Starr, take a very cursory look in the middle of February at Dave Road, found it to be more expensive, found other issues associated with Day Road that we thought were problematic. When we were directed to do a more complete process, we did just that, did the type of work that had been done at Damish, and determined that Day Road was a good site for the construction of this facility.
Yes, Mr. Starr.
It seems to me that the governor cited the prison at Damish for coming out there pushing dirt and building this facility.
Can't answer that question. There are issues still to address. I think the governor would like to see Day Road simply because it is a community that's supportive of it in Wilsonville. It benefits others as we do this. It's a better land use decision to use Damish for other purposes potentially. And if in fact we are responding to the direction of the legislative leadership and we have done the work on the site and determined Day Road to be a superior site, then it's the direction to head.
One last follow-up. Yes, sir. Day Road was identified late in the process as a it was an 11th hour compromise, supposedly, by a community for a site outside of the city limits closer to another community. Why is it that we can't have a 12th hour site at this point to identify the site of prison?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, and as you are aware and as others are certainly aware, this has been a very long process. We are now using facilities to try to temporarily house women. A decision, I think, is really an issue more of how much more money does the state want to spend looking at other options. At what point will we finally decide to build this site? We have an adequate, superior to damaged site that is ready to build on that we believe, and I think many others believe, is the appropriate location. And I think the governor is unwilling, and certainly others are unwilling to look at continuing options for sites when a good, workable, buildable site exists at Bay Road.
I'm sorry, I said that was last, but I got to do that one more.
Sorry.
You keep referring to the fact that legislative leadership supported moving the issue to Bay Road. At this point, it seems to me that we've had legislative leadership that are supporting, while we passed the bill, legislative leadership supported Purchase President Umatilla. I think it's fair to say that legislative leadership at this point is either undecided or are in the process of changing their decision. If legislative leadership were to say we want the prison to be built at a facility at Donald or somewhere along I-5 that's been identified, as the director of the Department of Corrections, would you respond to legislative leadership at that point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, it's a $750,000 per month cost to delay construction of the facility. It's approximately $400,000 to $500,000 cost to adequately assess the site. There has been no assessment done to date of the Donald site. There's also design delay that would play into the $750,000 per month delay. This would be a significant cost, and I think that as the Director of Corrections, I'm not supportive of a further delay in the process. And I think that you would find that that delay would be in the tune of $5 to $10 million in costs associated with a further look at sites when we have a an adequate buildable site.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I have a couple of my questions. There is one hanging up, or two maybe hanging up here yet. You said that you'd be ready to start building and you'd be breaking ground next May, 27 months to complete. Does that take into account the legal challenges that result from passing the Day Road site?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, that would depend on how the legislation is crafted that allows certain types of appeals, precludes others. I'm trying to recall the situation on Day Road, but I believe under the supersiting legislation, the appeals that are allowable under that have already been exhausted.
Follow up?
Yes.
So what I hear you saying, your suggestion is then that we take away citizens' rights to appeal and ram a prison down their throats rather than giving them due process for this thing built. Is that kind of what you just said?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, not at all. In fact, due process has been provided in this case. Hearings have been conducted. The ability to use the process has been used. It has been exhausted with the decisions from the courts, if I remember correctly, the situation with Day Road. You as a legislative body could provide further remedy to the those who oppose the site, but we are using the same opportunities for legal challenge that were in the original supersiting that was passed by the legislative body that directed the governor to site.
A couple more, Mr. Chair. You said you don't know why ground hasn't been broke at Damish. Isn't it in fact because there have been legal challenges and there's an injunction stopping that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I'm not aware of any injunction that's stopping any activity of Damish.
Different information then.
There's nothing that I'm aware of that does that. Those court decisions found in favor of the state. And, in fact, there are no legal issues that preclude the construction of that facility.
Mr. Barr, any more?
I'll do it.
Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I have a series of questions, but I'll first go to the questions that come forward by the questions from Representative Starr and Representative Beyer. In actuality, there have been no appeals filed relative to Bay Road at this point, correct?
He probably has a better recollection of the legal history than I do on that site.
Sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm sure you made a correction. You're correct. There is no legal action that has been filed.
Okay. My understanding, and I'm not an attorney, we have one attorney. Check again. We have one attorney on the committee, you said too, is that under the supersiding, the possible remedies would have been an appeal, probably relative normally to the constitutionality, which sort of a broad appeal, could have been appeal in some of the permits, or an appeal based on whether or not it had met the supersiding criteria. As the same as the minority report for SB3, but as Representative Mannix's amendment is written, the two appeals that would be left is probably broad constitutional issues and maybe some limited appeal of the permits. But I don't think if you go that route and basically cite it and don't speak about any criteria it having been met in the bill, that the appeal to whether or not it met criteria is probably not open to the opponents of Day Road. And I think that's one of the reasons why the bill is crafted in the sense that it's crafted, is because you'd have to go back to the supersiding criteria then, which it never went through the supersiding process. So that's probably why the governor's office has chosen to craft the bill in that way. Also point out the governor's office. Well, me. Okay. Thank you.
There's a small one.
But I mean, that bill, whether it's been drafted by the governor's office or my good friend Representative Mannix, basically follows the lines along the attorney general's opinion that the governor requested, and I have a copy of
that basically says you need to do these things or you'll be in court for a long time on this, unless you reopen the supersiding process and went through the process itself. But I just wanted to clear that up. I had a lot of questions that are pretty just straightforward questions. I mean, in the 97 session, we went through an extensive review of alternatives to damage. Approximately how many sites were reviewed?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, no disrespect intended, but we've answered these questions on numerous occasions when we were prepared to provide testimony. Our assumption in the work session setting was that you had clarification issues. Okay. We did not come prepared to answer in-depth detail around each of these citing questions.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, and I mean, I say no disrespect to the director. I just asked the question largely because the members of this committee, other than myself, have not been through all those previous sessions. I had the good fortune to be both on the Water and Environment Committee and on this committee. So I'll talk to the other members about that. I did want to, and some of the information has come forward about the review of the site. When you did the February review of the Bay Road site, who directed that that review be done?
Look back through our records.
Mr. Chair, my name is. That was subsequent to the e-board action in January where we did have the expenditure authority approved. That was when the initial designation of the site was, if you will, so we did go out at essentially DOC direction. Took a look at it. That was from February 11th to the 24th. It was a very short period of time for review. Did come to the conclusion that it would be, construction costs would be higher at that particular site. There were some security issues. Each of those, we took a further look at the direction of the governor when he asked us to go back and take another look at it. We did that. It was a 90-day process, and that was the one which was referenced for essentially $500,000. Did come to the conclusion that after that full review, if you will, that all the issues could be mitigated, security issues as well. So that was the second review.
And that did use the full consultation team that we've used on the other sites in determining all of the issues that were necessary to address.
Okay. But on follow-up, on the going back again, though, on that review that was completed and the press conference that was held after that review, in that case, I mean, even though it was a short review, the DOC comments about the site were relatively conclusive. I know people can change their minds. But at the April hearing that you had in Tualatin, the only, not actually hearing, but open house that was held in Tualatin, DOC staff and the governor's staff cited two reasons for proceeding with this, and if you want, I can play the videotape. The two reasons being cited were one, that the city of Wilsonville has agreed to limit off-site costs in terms of infrastructure, and two, the second reason being cited was that the appropriations process suit had been filed by ORPS and by a few others that potentially put a cloud on the issuance of the COPs, and that would hold up siting at damage for a relatively long period of time. I mean, those are word for words, the reasons given to the public at that meeting. Then one question I did have also, and then I'll get into just questions about the facility itself, is how much has been spent on damage so far if you take away the $2.5 million purchase of the property from Human Resources? I mean, I know you have actual designs for a facility there.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the original appropriation that we received last session to go take a look at that site did total $5.3 million. for damage specific. We have not spent that in its entirety. It is shy of that, and I don't want to take a guess at it, but the original amount approved was $5.3
million. Okay. Did that include the purchase or did not include
it? Did not.
Okay. Now, Mr. Cook, I just wanted to ask some basic questions about the facility itself.
Yeah, Mr. Daybird.
Either one, the facility they plan to build. Damas Bay Road, Umatilla, wherever it is. The intake is currently planned at 432 beds. We had some discussion in Water and Environment on whether or not 324 would be adequate. How's that current discussion going? I mean,
Mr. Chair, let us grab the text on this. This is a very complex issue, and I can't tell you right this minute how many beds are planned for that.
That's all right.
But you are accurate. The build is the 432 initially. One of the units at 108 beds will not be completed, but we intend to use inmate labor to go ahead and do the finishing work on that particular one. The three units at 108 will be done right up front. What I'm going to tell you in a second here, the intake numbers over time, I hope I'm going to tell you that. They do reach per month, in my memory, 472 or so intake a month. And our intake process is intended to be roughly 22 to 30 days. So, and when you're building out a facility of that size, you want to do your full construction all at one time. So that's my way of answering your question. Yes, we do need all those 432 beds.
Okay.
But it will be a phased construction, finishing on construction in order to accommodate your concern of spending that money up front. And we do allow the free use of inmate labor as well.
And that's based upon our experience at Snake River, where we are actually building an additional 2,300 beds while inmates were occupying the facility, trying to do all forms of construction assistance with the inmates. And there are costs and other issues associated with that are not necessary to spend in this project. If we build the additional 108 beds at the time of construction and simply finish them out with inmates, we alleviate a number of security issues, have some cost-benefit impact on it, and yet don't go into a phased construction very shortly after finishing this building, which would escalate the cost.
Follow-up, and on the minimum and medium security, I think the figures that you gave me before are fine, but I just wanted the committee to be aware of them. The 324 minimum originally, then adding another pod later, which would be 432 minimum, and then medium would be 432 originally, then later adding three pods, which would be another 324. And the only thing that's not included in all of those is the segregation. Probably the segregation cells, and I think you said 40, and then a small addition sometime later in the process.
That's correct. There are some special purpose beds, 10 infirmary beds, 14 special management units, and 40 of the high custody beds.
So we're talking about, in rough numbers, starting off at about 1,200, and then ultimate size about 16.
That's correct.
Good. Let's see where it goes. 1616 with an initial of 1252.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, another question. Mr. Cook, in your ideal scenario for this type of facility, what would be the acreage that you would like to have? I mean, under ideal circumstances, I'm not talking 200 here, given your changes that you've made. 200 probably not needed, but what would be your ideal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, we have spent several of the last months looking at ways to continue to work on this facility to use less footprint than we originally thought we would have to use. Some of that still trying to provide for buffering around the site, berming of the site, doing other things that protect the view by local residents and those people passing it.
I don't know that there is an ideal site. We believe the Day Road site is adequate. When this whole supersiting process began, you had the department looking for much larger sites, expecting in the case of the men's medium and minimum capacity facilities to double on those sites, as we intend to do it at Umatilla and Junction City and other locations. In the case of Wilsonville area, the Women's Prison Intake Center, we think the site that is identified here and at Damish are both adequate for this purpose. Could it be somewhat less than that? I suppose under certain circumstances it could be, but it's dependent in part upon the configuration of it and the surrounding kind of natural effects that are in place as well. This site is adequate, and in the initial statements that I made that I found fault with this site, we were concerned about the railroad track, we were concerned about some other issues. We have, through design and through kind of continuing conversation and the reassessment of that whole thing more explicitly, decided that we can make that work by making some modifications to the design of the institution. Okay. I haven't answered your question directly on the amount of acreage, but I don't know that there is a specific amount of acreage. It is dependent, in fact, upon the location and the layout of the site specifically in the terrain.
Mr. Chairman, a final question and just a request, actually. In addition to the earlier request that I made to you, I get a copy of the infrastructure and operational agreement, proposed agreement with the City of Wilsonville. And the final question is, the state has not made any contractual arrangements with Wilsonville at this point, have they, relative to this item?
No final contractual arrangement has been made on the Wilsonville side, is the question.
No, sir. We do have negotiations have been going on. There is a draft agreement. We're working toward getting it signed this week, but there's nothing to do some signed so far.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. But you would not be signing anything on behalf of the state until you resolve this issue, right?
That's correct, sir.
Or you would have something in the agreement that says it's depending upon title action.
Yes. Should this be the site, we would prefer to have everything in order and in place, certainly to share with the assembly as to what that agreement is. That's what we've been working towards.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Edwards.
I have my list of inquisition as well.
I was delighted to hear.
I'm sure y'all do.
Actually, I have just a few questions. And I am relatively new as far as hearing your testimony, so you can bear with me. Unlike my friend from Lake Street or 12. I guess one of the things that I'd be curious to know a little more history about, when was the criteria that this prison had to be sited in the metro region? Was that, can you give me just a little bit of history as to when that was interjected, or was that the initial criteria placed before the siting commission?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, and let me apologize to Representative Devlin. As I said earlier, this is a long road. It's a very frustrating road for a number of people, and if I'm short with my temper, I apologize for that. I did not mean to imply that other people knew as much as you knew about this, and I understand your need to get this on the record, so you have my apologies. I lose my cool on this issue probably more than I should, because it is dragged on for a significant period of time. Editorializing aside, Mr. Edwards, the initial work that the department did was to site 8 prison sites for an anticipated prison population of about 19,500. This coming off the top of my head. Every 6 months, required by law, the Office of Economic Analysis out of DAS is required to do prison population forecasting. Shortly after we began this process, there were 3, I think, subsequent forecasts which showed significant decline in the expected numbers of prisoners that would be necessary to be housed by the year 2008 to 2010, somewhere in there, actually about 2005 to 2008. The determination was made that 7 sites would be sited as we move through this process. We're simultaneously looking for those sites. The governor's office was presented with options on all 7 locations, plus some expansions we were doing. It was determined at the time, these came from the volunteer siting authority that was charged by the governor with the purpose of finding these sites and making recommendations to the governor's office. The governor directed the Department of Corrections to, when damage, I'll leave the other ones aside, they have to do with Junction or Jackson County and Lane County, but as it relates to the Women Prison Intake Center, damage was the selected site. The governor, after some decisions around this and some consultation with us, directed that we go look in the metropolitan area, the Tri-County area, for the Women Prison Intake Center, and damage continued to be, so jump in any time with the records.
Might I clarify just one thing? The initial siting process was what the director just took you through, and that was through December of 96. The governor actually deferred the three that he was talking to, said keep those sites on the list in Jackson Lane County and the damaged property, but go back out one more time and take a look at other sites. And that's when the Tri-County designation was put in for specifically the Women's Prison Intake Center.
Just so I understand that, as far as, was it a reason because of this facility? I mean, as far as, does this one lend itself better to the criteria of looking in the Tri-County area versus the others that you were describing?
We could run through the numbers for you, specifically Representative Edwards, on the number of inmates that come from the metropolitan area. But in fact, the Tri-County area represents somewhere in the neighborhood of about 56% of all the inmates that come to the Department of Corrections. As it relates to the women, most, I think in excess of 70% of them come from the Tri-County area, adding Marion and Lane counties. There are issues around the programming costs, visitation of families to the location, and simply the fact that reintroduction into the community for those inmates was facilitated by having that facility in the Tri-County area. There were also directions given on the other sites, Lane County and the Jackson County sites, simply because the communities made it very clear that they did not disagree with the fact that the department had the authority to site in those locations, but they thought they could produce better sites than the siting authority had produced in the recommendation to the governor. And so the department was looking at both of those communities again for what would be considered by the community to be improved sites over the ones that were recommended. And damage remained, as Sue said, damage remained on the list as the preferential site if a superior site was not located.
Maybe you could give me just on paper just background about how, and I'm just thinking of the mechanics, just so I feel comfortable about the mechanics. You have a commission that's appointed by the governor, and then helps. How do you interject? I mean, they give a recommendation to the governor, and then what's your interaction with that commission?
Our interaction with the commission had been to staff that, to provide setup work for them, to help manage the hearing process, to provide technical information to those members of the siting authority.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representing, in addition to that, the Department of Corrections has to nominate sites to the siting authority. So there was an initial look. We didn't, certainly mailings, we had informational hearings in many, many areas of the state. So the department actually did advance sites for the siting authority, who actually then did nominate to the governor. And that's in statute. The siting authority is in statute.
If, in fact, sites were not forthcoming from the community as well, the department had an obligation to recommend sites to the siting authority absent any resolution of interest from various communities.
Great. A couple more questions. Thank you for your testimony today. I think I heard you say the cost of delaying this is approximately $750,000 per month. That is putting it in, is that based on damage, or is that Bay Road, or I'd like to see how that was, and maybe I'm misquoting the number, was that right, and then if so, could I see how you calculated, what is it costing us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, you're not miscalculating the numbers. We do have a worksheet on that broke down all the costs in terms of the delay that has been provided in the past. We'll certainly provide it again. I don't know that we have a copy with you.
Whenever.
It represents the cost associated with delay and an array of other issues that come into play, including use of other beds and rental beds potential. We'll go back through it and get it ready.
You made two other issues around cost. You said something that costs $5 to $10 million. You made some statements. I'm trying to remember what you were saying. Something about,
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, what I was saying is if you accept the $750,000 per month delay, and if you take a site that is not currently a site that has been evaluated, and add the cost of evaluation to that, and given the time it will take to do the evaluation and the redesign of the facility for that particular location, I made some very broad range statements. It may be somewhat less than that, maybe somewhat more than that. But the cost to design the facility is site relative, so that the facility itself has basic design parameters, but it is site specific in terms of its final design.
And that kind of led me to the question of, you said there was a cost, if we were looking at other sites than just the two that are out there and the amendment that's being offered by Representative Mannix, what was the cost? Do you know what the costs are? I mean, is that site specific? That is, if we were to say, here's a look at this one or two other sites, can you give me a price tag what it costs to do that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the initial site work, just to do the study, is roughly $125,000 a site. That does not get you your complete site work. That was the $500,000 reference that we actually did in at Bay Road to work through all the environmental issues and those kinds of goal studies. But the generic study, just to see whether or not it is functional, is about $125,000.
Last thing, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your indulgence. The last thing was about what's going to happen with damage if it does not become a prison site. And that is, as I understand it, the urban village will move forward, or at least that concept, which has been around for some time. If I recall, the amendment, I believe, would have the state sell that. Is that correct? And is there a willing buyer out there? This is assuming that your amendment is what's adopted.
Mr. Chair, the -11 designates that damage will not be used for a prison, essentially. There's another measure which is in Ways and Means right now. They have a hearing, I think, on Thursday. Mm-hmm. House Bill 3446. Which will ask for the sale of damage and proceeds to be used for mental health, community, and institutional
housing. Okay, is that
it, Representative
Edwards?
That's all you know?
That's in Manic.
Thank you. So if it costs us about $750,000 for each month of delay, if I have three bills and Ways and Means that have a fiscal impact of $250,000 each, which I do, by the way, which are slowly getting out, we every month we wait, we have another three criminal justice reform bills on average that we have to lose because we just blew $750,000.
In mind, we're some interesting issues.
Sure, Representative Manning, but I assume that's not an accurate equation.
That's the way I calculate these things. Then in terms of human costs, we haven't talked about human costs. We have an obsolescent women's prison which provides adequate programs and facilities under constitutional and statutory standards, but which is not really up to snuff in terms of what you could do to help rehabilitate women prisoners and put them to work if you have this new facility online. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, that's a very fair statement. That doesn't begin to address the issues around security that are prevalent at that institution as well.
And in addition, the intake center, if it's established, will relieve the problem in Clackamas County in terms of their need for a true jail facility, which they presently are not able to fully implement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, it not only relieves their concerns, but it also meets the statutory obligation that the state has to turn over that facility to Clackamas County.
Now, we've heard some talk about jamming things down the throats of citizens. Actually, there's two jamming concerns. One would be the siting process, but the super siting process itself is a legislative statement that because land use planning doesn't really contemplate state prisons, we will set up a special process to hear the concerns of citizens and then proceed to allow their concerns to be addressed, but we do it differently from the typical land use process. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, that's correct.
Then as to the alternative, the alternative is really the condemnation situation, and there's two phases to condemnation. One is the taking, the other is just compensation. Is there anything in any of the legislation in front of us today, other than allowing for the taking, which we've been able to do since the day we became a state, is there anything that denies any citizens the right to have access to the courts, to have an adjudication as to what their fair compensation will be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, none whatsoever that I'm aware of.
And as the process works, the taking can be commenced, that is, the property taken over, but the citizen is given the full time that's necessary to adjudicate fully whatever value may be ascertained as to the property that's been taken from the citizen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, that's correct, and in fact, we have gone through that process in several cases with the Department of Corrections now on existing sites.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Devlin, one more?
Yeah. Follow-up to Representative Mannix. The price that was given for the development at Bay Road is approximately $181 million. Is that the facility as built out, or is that the facility as originally constructed?
Mr. Chair and Representative, let me answer you in a different way, if I can. In our conversation with Ways and Means, which ended just not too long ago, the estimates that we are giving for construction of Day Road on the initial bill is $171.7 million. What's happened between last fall and now is we've learned something, and that came from construction of both SRCI in Ontario and the Two Rivers construction project in Umatilla. There are ways to do construction more cost-effectively than we knew of before, so we're folding those into to the current plan. So the current cost of that facility is $171.7. That will take you to basically your structure, and as you talked about before, your intake, you'll have your four units there to be completed on the inside a little bit later. And your full build out then will add your minimum unit and a medium unit later, which are not funded in that 171.7.
Okay. And follow up also, in terms of cost savings, the $750,000 is the same estimate that was given in June of last year. If any time during that, and I'm not advocating that the governor would do that, had decided to move on damage, she could have saved $750,000 a month, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, during that time, we did have a filing on the lawsuit which challenged the funding mechanism through the emergency board. So the Department of Administrative Services did not and actually would not go ahead and sell COPs to finance it because of the cloud on that particular funding mechanism. That's the lawsuit which was settled in the state's favor, has been challenged, and I think that challenge
is still
on
appeal.
I'm sorry?
It's still on appeal.
Okay. It's on appeal. But it wasn't deciding, it wasn't those other issues. It was the funding part of it which was the challenge.
Yeah. It'll be kind of moot in 2 days.
Thank you very much for coming today, both of you, and taking our questions. If you have further questions specifically for the department, we will get in touch with you. And
thank you
very much. You know what it is? For the committee, we are adjourned.